Welcome to the Tell Us Something podcast. Tell Us Something is a nonprofit that helps people share their true personal stories around a theme, live, in person, and without notes. I'm Mark Moss, your host and executive director of Tell Us Something. Have you ever felt that tug towards a place, a memory, or maybe even a person? That feeling of going home? That feeling of going home isn't just about a physical location. It's about belonging and connection. It's about finding that piece of yourself that's been missing. On this episode of the Tell Us Something podcast, we explore all the different ways we come home to ourselves and the world around us. We'll hear stories of journeys, of second chances, of rediscovering what truly matters. So buckle up and get comfy. Join us as we embark on these heartfelt adventures. This episode of the podcast was recorded in front of a live audience at the Glacier Ice Rink and Pavilion on June 11th, 2024, as part of the Missoula Pride Celebration. 8 storytellers shared their true personal stories on the theme, Going Home.
A few days later, my mom called me to share a story. She said she had just been on the phone with my grandmother and that she was terribly upset because apparently her cousin had called to ask how my father had enjoyed the bacon.
So you're going to North Dakota after that? Wait, where are you stopping at? Salt Lake City? As soon as you get there, call me. Just, you know, he kept saying, call me, let me know where you're at. And I knew it was because of that Club Q shooting.
For 7 years with Sarah, I was in hiding, and actually I had my kids in hiding too. Initially, she was very patient with it all, but eventually she decided that she was living my life in hiding with me and not her life, because she had actually come out when she was in her 20s.
So I loved women on Hawthorne and in Portland for 8 years. And there was drama, there were tears, there was joy, there was heartbreak. And I really sort of saw the first glimpse of my real self during that time.
That's coming up. We are currently looking for storytellers for the next Tell Us Something storytelling event. The theme is Never Again. If you'd like to pitch your story for consideration, please call 406-203-4683. You have 3 minutes to leave your pitch. The pitch deadline is August 9th. I look forward to hearing from you. We're also looking for volunteers to help with the event. If you love Tell Us Something and you love helping out, visit tellussomething.org/volunteer to learn more and to sign up. We were gathered at the Missoula County Fairgrounds in the heart of Montana amidst the vibrant energy of early June. As we remembered that, we took a moment to acknowledge the traditional stewards of this land. We stand on the ancestral homelands of the Salish and Kalispell people who for countless generations have nurtured and cared for this place, the place of the small bull trout. Their deep connection to this land is woven into the very fabric of this valley. We honor their resilience, their knowledge of the natural world, and their enduring presence here. Acknowledgement alone is not enough. Let's also commit to taking action. Ways that you can do this if you live in Missoula are to learn more about the native tribes who still inhabit this land. You can visit the Salish Kootenai College or the Missoula Children's Museum to deepen your understanding of the Salish and Kalispell cultures. You can visit the Missoula Art Museum, where the exhibit We Stand With You, Contemporary Artists Honor the Families of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relative Crisis, runs through September 7, 2024. You can support cultural events hosted by local tribes and explore opportunities to volunteer with their initiatives. We can always be looking for opportunities to incorporate Indigenous knowledge and practices into our everyday lives. Whether it's sustainable land management or traditional food systems, we can commit to moving beyond mere words and work towards building a more respectful and inclusive future, honoring the legacy of the Salish and the Kalispell people on whose land we stand. Remember this, Tell Us Something stories sometimes have adult themes. Storytellers sometimes use adult language. We at Tell Us Something recognize the privilege inherent in our platform, and While we love sharing a variety of voices, it's important to amplify marginalized voices. That's why, during the event on June 11th, I stepped back and passed the mic to our friends from Missoula Pride, Devin Carpenter, who shared a story at last year's event, and Kira Rivera from the Center, performed the honors of emceeing the evening's event. On the podcast, you'll hear them giving the bios for the storytellers. In our first story, Kiki Hubbard, her mother, and her grandmother are on a plane returning back to the United States from former Yugoslavia after a trip tracing their ancestry. The grandmother, a strong immigrant who fled war and violence, is frustrated because customs won't let her bring bacon into the United States. Kiki calls her story, "What Bacon?" Thanks for listening.
I'm on an airplane home from Europe with my mother and grandmother. To my left is my grandma, Francesca, who went by Frances, but who my family affectionately called Momo. I know she's next to me because I can sense her signature fidgeting. Momo was a constant worrier. It was as if anxiety propelled her through life, which kept her busy, I suppose, because she was always knitting, gardening, cooking, doing. And she moved at a rapid pace, regardless of what she was up to. For example, if you saw her doing her laps at the mall, you would quickly conclude that she was either racing someone or racing away from someone. This is a woman who never became a U.S. citizen, despite being in the United States for over 50 years as an immigrant, because she was terrified of failing the exam. She was ashamed of making mistakes and having people learn about them. And I suppose at a deeper level, she was afraid of being told that she couldn't stay in this country. Now, standing no more than 5 feet tall, Momo was also one of the strongest people I have ever known. She chopped firewood with an axe well into her 80s. She would flip burning logs in the fireplace with her bare hands. After emigrating here, she chopped off half of her pointer finger while working in a bakery in Milwaukee. She simply wrapped her hand in a towel and kept working. It wasn't until her supervisor caught wind of the situation that she was taken to the emergency room. Now, sitting next to me to my right on the airplane is my mom. My mom was born and raised in Austria. When she emigrated here with her parents, she was forced to grow up faster than most nine-year-olds because she picked up the English language quicker than they did. She read the mail, scheduled appointments. She had to navigate the complex systems that came with living in a new country. And while Austria is where my mom was born, my grandmother used to call former Yugoslavia her home, where she and my grandfather farmed and lived in community with a number of other ethnic Germans whose ancestors had emigrated to Yugoslavia and other countries along the Danube River more than 250 years before. In fact, the impetus for our trip to Austria, from which we were returning to on that airplane, was a research grant that I was awarded as a college undergraduate. I was provided some funding to travel to Austria to interview relatives I had never met before about my cultural heritage, and in particular, how my grandma landed in Austria in 1944 as a war refugee. My grandmother survived a genocide event that rarely makes it into history books. See, following the fall of Hitler at the end of World War II, the communist leader in Yugoslavia, Tito, initiated a mass liquidation of anyone with German ancestry. So even though my grandparents had never set foot in Germany, they had German roots, and all ethnic Germans were stripped of their citizenship and property rights and told they had to leave the country. Those who didn't heed the warning were either faced torture, death, or slave labor camps. My grandparents were among the lucky, if you can call them that, because they were given 3 days to leave their land. They packed up their prized possessions in a covered wagon, said goodbye to their farm, their livestock, their vineyard, their friends, and they joined a procession with other ethnic Germans headed toward Austria. They were told the trip would take 2 weeks. In fact, it took a full month, and they survived off the kindness of strangers and off of a single smoked pig that they prepared before leaving Yugoslavia. When they arrived in Austria, they had high hopes that they would be able to return to Yugoslavia. But when they started to hear from survivors there, they learned that there was no home to return to. Their land had been given away to members of the army. This dispossession of land would haunt my grandfather in particular for decades. I remember him as a despondent man whose mind was very far away. But although the army could take away their land, they could not take away their traditions. And some of my fondest memories with my grandfather are sitting next to a bonfire, next to a lake in northern Wisconsin, cooking bacon over an open flame. I'm not talking about your typical Sunday morning bacon. I'm talking 4 to 5 inch slabs of bacon that you can only find at a butcher shop. My siblings and I would search the forest floor for the best sticks to whittle into skewers for the bacon. My grandpa taught us how to pepper and salt the bacon and cut slits into the slabs and slowly cook it over the flames. As the bacon sizzled and the grease started to drip, he taught us to catch those grease drippings on slices of white bread that had copious amounts of paprika sprinkled on them. Roasting bacon over an open fire only happened once or twice a year, but I can still taste the charred pork and the greasy, spongy bread. As the airplane begins to make its descent into Chicago, my grandmother leans over me to ask my mom a question. Muss ich Ihnen von dem Speck erzählen? What bacon? My mom asked. My grandma then proceeded to explain to my mom that her cousin had gone to the butcher shop in Austria and found the choicest cut of bacon to send home with my grandma as a gift for my father. Now, what prompted this disclosure were repeated announcements by flight attendants explaining that because of a foot and mouth disease outbreak, certain products weren't being allowed into the United States, including meat. Now, mind you, my grandmother already had one item confiscated at the airport in Europe. They took a dagger-sized letter opener out of her purse before going through security. This, too, was a gift from my father. And this she could wrap her head around. After all, it had only been 3 short months since the World Trade Center had been attacked, and travel security was clearly different. At some point, my mother must have conflated foot and mouth disease with mad cow disease, because I'm sitting in between them, hearing my grandma argue why she should be able to keep the bacon, asking why are the cows mad? And her cows were never mad because she treated them well. And after all, this pork is from a pig, so why should it matter? It shouldn't be confiscated. I'm in between them picking up bits and pieces of this conversation, one, because I only understand so much German, and two, because I was somewhat delirious. I had developed a 103 fever on the 10-hour flight home from Europe. I was terribly sick, and I was desperate to get off this plane. As we were deboarding, it became clearer and clearer that my grandma did not want to give up this bacon. My mom was sensing this, and without any warning, she shoved her hand into my grandma's purse, located the white butcher paper-wrapped meat, and beelined it for the women's bathroom. I remember thinking to myself, I guess we're not going to turn this over to the authorities. My grandma and I are at her heels, but by the time we got to the bathroom, the meat was already in the trash can. My mom pushed it way down deep into this large trash can in the women's bathroom. My grandma is still protesting, "Das ist eine Sünde! This is a sin!" We turned around and headed toward the baggage claim area. I let my mom and grandma look for our luggage. I was feeling sicker by the minute and told them I was just going to sit next to the wall and rest. I hadn't even gotten settled next to the wall when I see my grandmother race past me, clutching her purse. I'm a little bit worried about her, so I start to stand up, and I see her run past me again, clutching her purse. This time, I notice that there are 3 beagles at her heels. and they're tethered to three men in uniform. I start following my grandmother, and I see that she's located my mom, and she throws her purse into my mom's face and keeps running. And I shouldn't say she was running so much as speed walking. It was as if all of the laps at the mall had prepared her for this very moment. The three beagles stopped at my mom's feet, sat down, and just looked up at her. She's holding the purse, humiliated, and I walk over to my mom to help support her in these conversations. She's being interrogated by these three men in uniform. I was struck that the men were with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they had guns. I was also struck that they had beagles, as opposed to, say, German Shepherds or Labradors. It turns out the USDA's detector dogs is known as the Beagle Brigade. And the Beagle Brigade's job is to find the bacon and protect America's food supply. My mom sheepishly led the authorities to the bathroom, helped them locate the meat, and then my mom and I sat down for what felt like 2 hours to fill out paperwork for this slab of bacon. Meanwhile, my grandma's nowhere in sight. We finally made it through customs, where we were reunited with my grandma and my dad, who was driving us home. A few days later, my mom called me to share a story. She said she had just been on the phone with my grandmother and that she was terribly upset because apparently her cousin had called to ask how my father had enjoyed the bacon. She felt like she had to lie and was lamenting that she had to lie and was yelling in the phone to my mother, "Eine weitere Sünde, another sin." I asked my mom how she was doing. "Where is Momo now? Is she at home?" "Oh no, honey," she replied. "Your grandmother is at confession."
Kiki Hubbard graduated from the University of Montana's Environmental Studies program and now works remotely for the University of Wisconsin-Madison as an academic collaborator with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Kiki lives in Missoula by way of Wisconsin and Washington, D.C., and is a national expert in policy issues that affect our nation's seed supply. She's passionate about protecting family farms and community food systems from unfair and destructive corporate practices.
Next up is Adria Jort, who, as a trans woman, wrestles with Montana's anti-LGBTQ climate and complex relationship with her dad. The Club Q shooting prompts her to return home, prioritizing family despite ongoing struggles. We call her story, From Vegas to Montana, A Father's Call. Thanks for listening.
And then there was that one time I didn't want to come back home to Montana. It was a place that felt like where colonization made me feel like an alien in my own land. But there's also this scene that I keep coming back to, including yesterday, where I cruise from Billings, right? And I go to Helena, Missoula, Livingston, Yellowstone Park, wherever. I had taken this trip literally probably a couple hundred times by now. But when you round a bend past Columbus, right before Big Timber, you could see the crazy mountains peer into view. And they're just so freaking magnificent. I remember 2 weeks ago when I came up here, I just remember the sky was like this piercing blue. I didn't even know how to describe it. I'd never seen the sky that color. It was just described as neon. And it made the crazy mountains like seem 3D. And I was going to take out a camera, pull over, and take a picture. It's photographic, and I appreciated the art of it. But for that time, I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to keep this one for my memory. But going back to the time I didn't want to come back to Montana, I had been at a Las Vegas writing fellowship. And while there, I just felt like I'd felt my, or had my social tribe, whatever, fellow Gothlings and everything. And I lived in the arts district, and I just felt like safe. And I had just been through hell in Montana the last year. I had been through some lawsuit and are like literally hosting rallies where my name was being projected on screens and everything, and I was getting all kinds of threats. I actually won a libel lawsuit because the guy couldn't stop threatening me, and like people were showing up to where they thought I worked and everything, just calling me pedophile, groomer, whatever, and they're going to, you know, find me, I guess. But anyway, so I win the lawsuit, and I'm in Las Vegas, had a settlement, and I just kept driving by apartments, like wanting, like, wow, I could afford down payments, and it's, maybe he's get a job here, and it's all going through my head and everything. I didn't, you know, but there's also this pull back to here. But at the same time, at the end of my fellowship, the Club Q shooting happened. And I remember it distinctly because I'd come back from the goth club and I was just feeling like so chill, like maybe, yeah, this is the spot. This is it. I think I want to live here. And I open up my Twitter feed, start scrolling, and right away I see this comment. It's like, hey, has anyone seen my friend? They perform at Club Q. Has anyone seen them? And it was just like weird seeing these three texts. Has anyone seen them? Are they safe? Are they okay? They perform there. And I was like, just trying to figure it out. And it all came together that night that there was a mass shooting. And yeah, and it was just so surreal watching all these stories come together, just people just like looking for their family, their friends, their best friends, drag performers, whoever, all the gay club shot up. And that Monday, there is a anti-drag queen bill introduced. I was like, oh, what good timing. And by then I was like, yeah, fuck Montana. I ain't coming back. And I knew it was going to get worse. And I was telling people this and they just thought I was crying wolf, whatever. But it's like, okay, yeah, you guys can deal with your own stuff up there. I'm just going to stay here. But that night, my dad called, and we'd always had a complex relationship with my being trans. I mean, to call it complex is an understatement. He was like, when I came out trans, I mean, he was like kind of in denial of it. I mean, I was just kind of going day then, whatever. But one day he saw me in the newspaper. I'm also in the newspaper as an activist, and was wearing a dress and everything. And then I guess that was basically out of the closet for him. And he just freaked out and everything. His kid is on the front page of the local state section as, you know, it was a terrible picture. I remember that. It was like, but anyways, he freaked out like bad. Like my stepmother, she texted me saying, I never seen your dad like this. He's like distraught. He's whatever. I've never seen him like this off in his head, you know, and he'd always been, and it would like hurt really bad because I didn't expect him to accept it. He'd always been like an evangelical Christian, but a deacon of the church, but he's like a legit good guy. I mean, when growing up, we used to like all take all these kids at this Royal Rangers, it was called, it was kind of a Boy Scout group. So he'd take them to the mountains. They're all underprivileged kids from the poor parts of Billings. And they were just like, you know, he'd take about 10 of them in his Volkswagen van. And, you know, that was what he liked doing. He just liked being a good Christian guy, I guess. I just really looked up to him. And there's like, he also like raised us, three of us boys, growing up basically as a single father lots of times because of my mom. She would also go on, I'd say, drunk benders. And one time she left for about 8 months. And after a few months, we just cruised around looking for her. And I remember we pulled out of some downtown Billings bar and I just seen her pulling her out. And then these other guys like, hey, get your hands off her. And my dad, I never seen him get violent before, but he cocks his fist back and goes, those are her kids over there. We're sitting in the back of a truck, like the little cab of a Mazda. And then they all just backed off. And then they said, you better go talk to your kids. My mom came over and it was like, if whenever I want to cry, like if I was an actress in a movie, I needed to come up with a scene to make me cry, that would be it. It was my mom saying, I guess this is our final goodbye. Except I didn't cry. I just like learned to stop crying right then because my little brother, a year younger than me, he put his head in my lap and just started bawling. And I just had to be there and comfort him. So, and his like little head cried big tears. And it was just so, I don't know. I just kind of lost emotions for a while. And that's always the thing that always comes back and haunts me. But so my dad, he dealt with a lot of that. And I won a 40 Under 40 award once. And then they said, who's your hero? And I put, my dad. That's, and I put it and meant it. So for him to just like, just totally just freak out about my being trans was so just made me very distraught. I think I already said that word, but anyways. So, but that Monday after Club Q shooting, he calls up, and I started calling him back after a few months, and we kind of restored our relationship because we always called each other. It was always like, I mean, we missed each other. So of course he still loved me. He didn't approve of my lifestyle, as they say, but as I kind of try to explain Gothic as a lifestyle, being trans isn't, but you know, but he's old school evangelical. That's his religious beliefs. And it's like, we like to like judge and like say, but you know, to him, it was just his religious belief. And I don't excuse it, but at the same time, it was just like, you know, he called that, yeah, 2 days after Club Q shooting, and after I was decided not to come back, and he was very, very concerned, like, hey, when are you coming back? And I never heard that in his voice before. Okay, are you okay there? You know, okay, how are you getting back? So you're going to North Dakota after that? Wait, where are you stopping at? Salt Lake City? As soon as you get there, call me. Just, you know, he kept saying, call me, let me know where you're at. And I knew it was because of that Club Q shooting. I knew it was because he knew that his kid could die just for being LGBTQ. And that was in his head. And I mean, he didn't say that, but I'd never heard it in his voice before. And he already had my little brother, who was a year younger, he's been murdered, and he knew he didn't want to lose another son, but just son who became daughter. So that was it, right? I mean I was still churning it and everything, and I said, yeah, maybe I better come back and get my stuff, you know. And I was still thinking all that, but then I saw this article, the paper, some guy had been shot like 7 times. He'd survived Club Q. He'd been to Colorado, or just been there from North Carolina, I believe, all the details. But anyways, he wasn't even LGBTQ. He just saw this club going on, and it's hip and happening because us gays, we are good at partying. And it's like, hey, cool. But he ended up getting shot 7 times, left the club, made it two blocks away to a 7-Eleven. They cut his shirt open and everything. And everyone in there, that 7-Eleven, trying to keep him alive. And all I could think was, I just want to call my dad. He's fading in and out. He said, that's the last thing I wanted to do. It's like, is call my dad. That's my best friend right there. And before I die, can you give, you know, that's his only thought. And I just felt that so much right there. And it's like, you know what? It's just sometimes it's like that's basically it right there. That's one of the things that said I just can't leave my family, I guess. So that's why I'm back here. So thank you very much.
Adria Dwart is a Northern Cheyenne fiction writer and transgender two-spirit journalist based in Billings, Montana. Her writing has appeared in the Los Angeles Review of Books, Electric Literature, and Indian Country Today, among other publications. She is the executive director of the nonprofit Indigenous Transilience.
We'll be right back after this short break. You are listening to the Tell Us Something podcast.
For 7 years with Sarah, I was in hiding, and actually I had my kids in hiding too. Initially, she was very patient with it all, but eventually she decided that she was living my life in hiding with me and not her life, because she had actually come out when she was in her 20s.
So I loved women on Hawthorne and in Portland for 8 years. And there was drama, there were tears, there was joy, there was heartbreak. And I really sort of saw the first glimpse of my real self during that time.
That's after the break. Stay tuned. Thank you to our story sponsor, The Good Food Store, helping us to pay our storytellers. Learn more at goodfoodstore.com. Thanks to Golden Yolk Griddle, who also showed up as a story sponsor. Learn more about them at goldenyolkgriddle.com. Thank you to our accessibility sponsor, Parkside Credit Union, allowing us to hire American Sign Language interpreters at this event in order to be a more inclusive experience. Learn about them at parksidefcu.com. Thanks to our artist sponsor, Bernice's Bakery, who paid our poster artist. Learn about them and their delicious baked goods at bernicesbakerymt.com. Thanks to our media sponsors, MissoulaEvents.net, The Art Attic, The Trail Less Traveled, and Missoula Broadcasting Company, including the family of ESPN Radio, The Trail 103.3, Jack FM, and Missoula's source for modern hits, U104.5. Thanks to our in-kind sponsors, Float Missoula. Learn more at floatmsla.com and Joyce of Tile. Learn about Joyce at joyceoftile.com. Please remember that our next event is September 18th at the George and Jane Dennison Theater. The theme is Never Again. You can pitch your story by calling 406-203-4683. Tickets are available right now at tellussomething.org. Please follow us on all of the standard social media channels and subscribe to our newsletter in order to be informed about all of our events. Welcome back. You are listening to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm your host, Mark Moss. In our next story, Terry Wing leaves Butte, Montana for convent life before leaving and finding love and family. Her journey home was a wild ride. Terry calls her story, Going Home the Long Way Around. Thanks for listening.
Oh my God. Okay, so I'm 18 years old, and I'm sitting on a train that's ready to leave Butte. This was before airplane travel was invented. And I've got three people that I graduated from high school with, and we're kind of terrified, excited, but terrified and worried about the choice we made. We are headed 1,000 miles across the country to Kansas, where we are going to join a convent. Now, before we left, my best friend hands me a box, and she says, don't open this until Rocker, which is like 20 miles away. So we get to Rocker, and we open the box. And there inside are about 10 baby jars with various forms of booze from her dad's cabinet, a jar of ice, a packet of Sin Sin breath mints, and a pack of cigarettes. And so for about 300 miles after Rocker, we weren't anxious anymore. It was really, really mellow. So I get to the convent, and there were so many things about it that were kind of weird to me. One of the things was the silence. I mean, I never really had tried it out. But at first it was just an hour in the afternoon. And so at a certain time in the afternoon, we would stay silent. I guess we were supposed to be praying. And then a bell would ring, and we would drop to our knees and kiss the floor. I hadn't kissed anything for a while, you know, so it was fine. Pretty much the silence was all day, except for 1 hour in the evening when we had what was called recreation, and we could talk to each other. But the nuns had a real problem with something they called particular friendships. And these were kind of spooky. And so if you were observed during that recreation time on more than a couple of occasions talking to the same person, you were pulled aside and talked to about these particular friendships, and they were not approved of, and they were very dangerous. I think what they're really talking about is particular lesbians. During the second year that I was there, the superior called me into her office one afternoon to talk about my dad. And she told me that my dad was in Butte in a hospital, and he'd been had surgery for cancer. And just 4 short months later, my dad, who had been my rock, my safe harbor, my protector in a dysfunctional family, he was gone at the age of 54. At the end of that summer, I got the news that I was assigned to go to Independence, Missouri, to a Catholic school to teach fourth grade. And I love that. I love little kids. And we were called a religious community, But in fact, we were eight individuals living together under one roof, completely isolated from each other, and it was really lonely. And so I talked to a friend of mine, and she said, you know, I think you need to figure this out. So why don't you go up to Topeka and talk to Dr. Hall, who's a therapist? He might help you out. So I go up there, and I'm with Dr. Hall for an hour, and he, every 5 minutes, he says, At the end of the hour, I'm impatient. I say, tell me what you think. What do you think? So he leans across the desk and he said, well, sister, I think you need to give it another year before you decide what to do. So I thanked him and left. And I'm driving back to Independence and I feel this rage building in my chest. And I think to myself, but Dr. Hall, you fucking son of a bitch. I have just told you that I've been unhappy for 6 years and you say, give it another year? So when I got back to Independence, I called the mother house and said, I'm out of here. So they gave me back my $100 dowry that I gave them when I entered, without interest, I might add. And so I had enough to buy a nice dress, to get a train ticket, still no airplanes, a train ticket back to Butte. And as the train is pulling out of Kansas City and I see the station disappearing through the windows, I thought, you know, I've really kind of come full circle because I'm sitting in the club car with a bourbon in one hand and a lit cigarette in the other. And I'm thinking, well, hello, Independence. As soon as I get to Butte and to my parents' house, as soon as I walked in the door, I knew this wasn't home anymore because my dad wasn't there. 4 years after he was gone, his clothes were all still in the closet. His hunting and fishing gear was still there. And I think I had a reaction of some really serious delayed grief. And so I knew it was not home. So after a little while, I left there and I went to Spokane to enroll at Gonzaga to finish my degree. And so I did that, and then after I graduated, I got a job. I thought maybe Spokane was the place to stay. But one of the biggest challenges I had was dating. Because you remember the last time I dated, I was dating high school boys. And now here I am, and I've got not one, but two young men. Like, one had a beard. And they're both interested in me. And I'm really thinking that they've got more on their mind than a particular friendship. And I'm still a virgin. And so I was not interested in that. So I did what any mature, responsible 20-something would do. I backed up my Mustang convertible, my old car, put everything I owned in it, put the top down, and got the hell out of town. And I came to Missoula for the first time. I came here and I enrolled in a graduate program in education at the university. And after that degree, I had some jobs in Missoula. I got married and had a 12-year marriage that ended up not working for either one of us. But I had two wonderful, sweet daughters, which was a real bonus. And then at the age of 40, to my surprise, I fell in love. And I'm talking, I fell really, really in love with Sarah. And Sarah was a beautiful woman, so sensuous. She had these beautiful blue eyes that I could just get lost in. And she was smart and funny. And at the time, though, I was the curriculum director for the Missoula School District. It was the 90s. pretty visible job. And I was really worried about how my living arrangement was going to impact my job. I was also really concerned about my girls, who at that time were in middle school. And in the 90s, there weren't that many kids who were open about having two moms or two dads. And so for 7 years with Sarah, I was in hiding, and actually I had my kids in hiding too. Initially, she was very patient with it all, but eventually she decided that she was living my life in hiding with me and not her life, because she had actually come out when she was in her 20s. And so she moved out and left. And I was thoroughly heartbroken, filled with pain of loss, with regret, with guilt. And so I tried to stay as numb as I could using alcohol. But you know, that doesn't work at all. And so I checked myself into an alcohol treatment program to get my head straight and get my feet on the ground. And it worked. And so a couple of years later, both of my kids graduated and left the nest. And so at that time, I just didn't feel like I could stay in Missoula anymore. There were the pain was still too raw of losing Sarah. And so I left and had a couple of jobs, thought I would try to fit in. I always felt like a visitor. So in 2014, I came back to Missoula, and I bought a house. And my daughters by that time were married. They have kids of their own. They've got three little boys who, have you ever noticed how noisy boys are? And they throw things. I mean, we have baseball games in my living room, and I'm guarding my windows the whole time. We've got fierce hockey games going on in my tiny kitchen. And for me, it is just such a joyful noise I love. I've connected with my former husband and his wife through all of these marriages, births, birthdays, celebrations, soccer games. And I find that I'm part of a really wonderful extended family now. And then there are my friends, and the people from back 20 years ago welcomed me back to Missoula. They let me know they still love me. For me, being with old friends feels like slipping my feet into a really well-worn pair of cozy slippers, the kind with that fuzzy stuff inside, that feels so familiar and so comfortable. And so years ago, I had left Missoula with a broken heart. Since I've been back, I have found more love and community than I ever thought I could experience. And I am so really, really glad that I'm home.
Terry Wing is a born and raised Montanan, the mother of two and a grandmother of three boys. Terry is a retired educator who loves dogs and other living things. She hasn't yet climbed tall mountains, run a marathon, or jumped out of a plane, though she says she may put those on her bucket list.
Our final storyteller in this episode, Chloe Williams, searches for happiness in love, places, and self-expression before finally figuring out what love is and where to find it. Chloe calls her story, "The Rusty Screeching Turn Toward Home." Thanks for listening.
The journey has been very long to find the answer. I looked for the answer in parents. I looked for the answer in love. And I've looked for the answer in places. For me, they were in none of those. The first place that I looked for the answer was in my mom. And she provided a roof over my head. In fact, many roofs, as you just heard. But holding on to her was like holding on to the tail of a burning comet that zigzagged through the world. She had mental illness, and it ping-ponged her out, off of men and off of spiritual practices, and then ricocheted her back to earth. And that answer hurt me and left me feeling dizzy and confused. The next place that I looked for the answer was in the idea of love. And the idea of love was shaped in me by Disney movies. Magenta princesses with huge smiles and that cheesy music that comes in with the happy endings. So by 3 years old, I would put myself to sleep every single night, laying my head exactly in the middle of my pillow and strategically placing my hair around my face in array, and then folding my hands over my stomach and waiting for love to save me. So I loved fiercely as I could muster. The first boy that I loved was Jesse, and he was supposed to be the Prince Charming from one of those movies. In reality, he was just a tall, lanky guy that lived in a basement room. And every time I walked down the dark wood stairs to his room, I thought, maybe this is it. But all I found in that room was that tinny soundtrack to the Street Fighter game and then the stale smell of bong water. The next person that I loved was Kelly, the first girl that I loved. And she lived in a really unsafe home. It was dangerous for her there. So we camped out in coffee shops in the Haight-Ashbury, and I would lean in to hear the poetry that she would write to me over the bangs and clangs of the espresso shots being pulled and that diesel drip smell of coffee that we could afford. And we would crawl into each other's eyes for safety. And then I got into college. I got into Mills College. And my mom was so excited. She was like, Chloe, it's so great that you got into an all-women's school because you won't be distracted at all. Little did she know that a month later, I fell for a very cute butch girl. And that girl handed me a book that felt like the manual to who I was supposed to be. So the book was Stone Butch Blues. And so I wore the makeup and had the long hair and wore the heels, and it really seemed to make her happy. But the other women at Mills said things like lesbian until graduation and made me feel like a trespasser in this world that I really wanted to belong to. So when that cute butch girl took me on a road trip to Portland, Oregon for the first time, singing the soundtrack to Rent at the top of her lungs the whole way, I thought, maybe it's a new city that's the answer. And so when I walked down Hawthorne Street in Portland, it felt like the green, beautiful trees that lined that street sort of just reached down and held me in an embrace. And I loved it there. The energy was exactly what I was looking for. It was the hub of the queer community. And I got a job right on Hawthorne Street, washing dishes at the Cup and Saucer Cafe, and I loved it. I washed those white plates, and the steam would rise up into my face, and I just got to watch all these beautiful women coming in and out of the cup. Spiky hair, cargo shorts, glinting eyes. And I remember a few shifts into my job there, I went home, went to the backyard and shaved all my long blonde hair off. And looking into the mirror the first time at myself with a shaved head, it felt like my skin just like fit a little bit better. So I stayed on Hawthorne for a long time. In fact, one morning I remember working at the Cup, I was standing at the counter waiting for customers to come in, and the cook, who I'd been eyeing for a few weeks, Amanda, came up to do some inventory, and she always wore this cute little train engineer hat off to the side. And as she was standing next to me, I felt like my cells were like vibrating. And I wanted to connect. I wanted to reach out and say something, but I didn't have the script. The script was old. I didn't work anymore. So I looked around and tried for something. And I tried reverse psychology. And I said, not you again. And that coy smile that she shot me in that moment, I was like, settled a little bit more into my body. So I loved women on Hawthorne and in Portland for 8 years. There was drama, there were tears, there was joy, there was heartbreak. And I really sort of saw the first glimpse of my real self during that time. But something was missing. And I did not know what it was. I got to a point, though, that I thought, well, maybe I'll try the exact opposite. Maybe I need a dude's dude. Maybe I need a hard-drinking, hard-fighting dude's dude. And I found him. I found him in the Sandy Hut Dive Bar in Portland. And I walked in that night, and there was Crash, sitting at the bar, tattered motorcycle sweater, scarred knuckles. And I thought, he looks like he could keep me safe. But trying to make Crash my answer was kind of like trying to train a wild dog. I had to sort of ignore the frothing and the growling to really get that house training in. But I tried for another 8 years to domesticate Crash. And with a ring on my finger and a baby in my arms and a house that we bought, I couldn't ignore the scars that I got from that wildness. But I followed that wildness all the way to Montana. Well, it turns out that parents are not the answer, at least not for me. And I've had to let my mom go for her to just kind of still be homeless and moving around and dealing with her mental illness without me on her coattails. Turns out love is not the answer, not when it's the kind of love that you have to sacrifice yourself for. And I had to let the wild dog go. Well, I wanted to let the wild dog go. And to be untamed and happy. And I love my half-wild son more every single day without losing myself. I actually took 6 years off of the idea of love because I really had to like reframe the whole Disney version and create my own version of love. And I get to do that today with an amazing woman who I can really be myself in front of. We get to witness each other settling into our skin more each day. It turns out that cities and places, San Francisco, Portland, Missoula, they are just cities with empty houses and empty streets unless you know how to make a home. Well, I choose to make my home in Missoula. And I choose to make it in my queer skin, which fits me so well. It turns out that the rusty, screeching, slow turn to myself was actually my home. I had to look away from all the people and the places and the things. I am my answer. I am my home. And I'm going home to myself in front of you right now. And I will be going home to myself for the rest of my life. Thank you.
Chloe Williams is many things. She is a speaker, a painter, a middle school teacher, a mother, a partner, and a friend. Hailing from the West Coast, Chloe was born in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and raised in San Francisco. She spent some summers on a farm in Illinois. Eventually, she spent 17 years in Portland, Oregon, and 10 years ago moved to Missoula. Chloe has lived approximately 40 different addresses in her life, though she really has lost count. Storytelling was passed down from her mom in the many long car rides of her childhood, and is her favorite thing her mother gave her. Only in the last few years has she been called to try storytelling herself, and it feels like something her spirit needs to do.
Thanks for listening to the Tell Us Something podcast. This episode was recorded live in person as part of the opening events at Missoula Pride on June 11th, 2024 at the Glacier Ice Rink Pavilion.
It was like looking through the most beautiful kaleidoscope I had ever looked through. All these vibrant colors and shapes and patterns, all fractals and wonder.
As she answers the phone, she softly says, "Hello?" And then silence. That silence felt like forever. But she breaks that silence with a delicate sob.
I didn't know what it meant, but I couldn't shake it. I thought maybe it was about my family, so I tried to write about it, but there was always something missing. It stayed with me for years.
The coolest thing you could do in town was go to the games, and I desperately wanted to be cool. So I went.
Tune in for those stories on the next Tell Us Something podcast. Please remember that our next event is September 18th at the George and Jane Dennison Theater. The theme is Never Again. You can pitch your story by calling 406-203-4683. Tickets are available currently at tellussomething.org. Please follow us on all the standard social media channels and subscribe to our newsletter in order to be informed about events and all things storytelling. Stream past episodes, learn more about upcoming events, and get tickets at tellussomething.org.